जय ओम विष्णु पाद परमहंस परमेश्वर चतुर्थ श्री श्रीमद जवान ग्रेस एसी भक्तिवेदांत स्वामी श्रील प्रभुपाद की जय। श्रीमद् भागवतम ग्रंथ राज की जय। और गौर से संबोध बौरीस और गौर संबोध बौरीस और गौर संबोध बौरीस गौर से श्री प्रभुपाद जय जय। Can somebody, whoever children these belong to, maybe they can take care of them? Also, it's time to turn off your phones. If you haven't turned your phone off, turn off the ringer. There'll be a fine. 100 rupees. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So today we're reading from the glorious Srimad Bhagavatam, the 6th canto, 2nd chapter, entitled Ajameel Delivered by the Vishnu Dutas, and it's going to be verse 26. Please repeat after me. Aho me paramam kashtam. Aho me paramam kashtam. Abhud avijitatmanaha. Abhud avijitatmanaha. Yena viplavitam brahma. Yena viplavitam brahma. Vishalyam jayatatmana. Vishalyam jayatatmana. Aho me paramam kastam. Abhudabhijitatmana. Ena viplavitam brahma. Vishalyam jayatatmana. Aho me paramam kastam. Abhudabhijitatmana. Ena viplavitam brahma. Vishalyam jayatatmana. Aho me paramam kastam. Abhudabhijitatmana. Yena viplavitam brahma. Vishalyam jayatatmana. Others? That's it. More. Aho me paramam kastam. Maharajis.
Aho, alas, may, my, paramam, extreme, kashtam, miserable condition, abhut, became, avichita, atmanaha, because my senses were uncontrolled. Yena, by which, iplavitam, destroyed. Brahma, all my brahminical qualifications. Vishalyam, through a shudrani, a maidservant. Jayata, being born, Atmana, by me. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. Ajamil said, alas, being a servant of my senses, how degraded I became. I fell down from my position as a duly qualified brahmana and begot children in the womb of a prostitute. Please repeat after me. Ajamila said, alas, being a servant of my senses, how degraded I became. I fell down from my position as a duly qualified brahmana and begot children in the womb of a prostitute. Report by Srila Prabhupada. Men of the higher classes, the brahmanas, kshatriyas, and vaishyas, do not beget children in the womb of lower class women. Therefore, the custom in Vedic society is to examine the horoscopes of the girl and boy before considering being considered for marriage to see whether this their combination is suitable. Vedic astrology reveals whether one has been born in the Viprak Varna, the Kshatriya Varna, the Vaishya Varna, or the Sudra Varna, according to the three qualities of material nature. This must be examined because a marriage between the boy of the Vipra Varna and a girl of the Shudra Varna is incompatible. Married life would be miserable for both husband and wife. Consequently, a boy should marry a girl of the same category. Of course, this is trigunya, a material calculation according to the Vedas. But if the boy and girl are devotees, there need be no such considerations. A devotee is transcendental, and therefore, in a marriage between devotees, the boy and girl form a very happy combination.
Amagyana Timrandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militamena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. I was born to the darkest of ignorance, but my spiritual master opened my eyes with a touch of knowledge. offer my respectful obeisances unto him. So in this verse, in the purport, Srila Prabhupada mentions that but if the boy and the girl are devotees, there need not be any considerations of matching horoscopes according to horoscopic calculations, combinations, considering the different gunas, etc. Now why is that? Just like Arjuna, he performed his prescribed duty as a Kshatriya to please Krishna. Right? At first, in the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, he didn't want to perform his prescribed duty. He didn't want to perform his dharma because he saw, because from dharma is comes what? Artha and kama, and then moksha. So he was seeing that by performing my prescribed duty of dharma, there was no artha, because everybody's going to be killed, and what to speak of kama after that. So he didn't want to do his prescribed duty. So Krishna says, no, you just do your prescribed duty to please me. That's basically the message of the Bhagavad Gita. So, if the boy and girl are devotees, then they perform their prescribed duty as a husband and wife, simply for the pleasure of Krishna. Just like Arjuna, he was killing all his relatives simply for the pleasure of Krishna. He killed his grandfather, killed his guru, killed all the members, all his cousins, killed everybody. There was, it was 18 Akshahinis of soldiers, right, on the battlefield of Kurukshetra approximately, I think, 9 and 11, that's 18. Isn't it? No, it was... Anyway, approximately 18. At the end, there was only 10 people left. There was 3 on the side of the Kauravas, Ashwatthama, Kritavarma, and Kripacharya, and on the side of the Pandavas, there was the 5 Pandavas, there was Krishna, and there was Satyaki. Other than that, millions and millions were killed just to please Krishna. So, that's the whole point of it, is you do whatever your prescribed duty may be simply to please Krishna. So if the boy and girl are devotees, then they will see, they will do everything in their life will be to please Krishna. They will see everything, they will want to be the best that they can be simply to please Krishna. They will be the best wife, the best mother, just to please Krishna. The husband will be he will be doing all his duties, supporting the family. The three main duties of the husband is to maintain the family, to protect the family, and to teach the family. Because it is the grihastha ashram, and that means it is the husband's ashram, and he is the guru, and the wife is his first disciple. So therefore he should know something, right? So he has to maintain the family, he has to protect. Now protection doesn't mean that he's like a bodyguard, he walks around with a gun and the wife does whatever she wants to do and he's just there to make sure nobody bothers her while she's doing it. No, protection means he's controlling the wife. It's like if you have a child, the parents protect the child by controlling the child. Ask any child, my mother doesn't want me to do this, my mother doesn't want me to do that, I can't do this, can't do that, can't be with this friend, can't eat what I want, because my mother tells me I can't do it. So protecting, because the mother is trying to protect the child, the mother's concerned about the welfare of the child, so it means restriction, control. You can't protect if you can't control. Right? You can't protect something you can't control. And then the husband has to teach the wife. Otherwise, what is the purpose? It's an ashram. So that means the husband has to be able to instruct his wife. He has to know something. He has to be learned in spiritual science. Right? So, if that's the situation, and both are devotees, then
things go along nicely. Because they're totally compatible in that they both want to serve Krishna. That overrides everything. Right? Like even like, for example, Srila Prabhupada, he was not particularly fond of his wife. In fact, he didn't like her much. But there was never any, even a thought of divorce because he was a devotee. And she also was a devotee of sorts. And he was just doing his prescribed duty to please Krishna. Right? That is the way a Vaishnava, a real Vaishnava, they do everything. You know, if they're employed, they do the best job. You know, if they're a computer programmer, then they try to be the best computer programmer. Why? Because they're offering that to Krishna. Right? If they have some business, they try to be the best in that business because they're offering that to Krishna. They see everything as an offering to Krishna. Whatever their action is an offering to Krishna. That way, everything is Krishna conscious because they're seeing that they are servants of Krishna. As explained, I think it's in 1860 that Srila Prabhupada says in the purport that one should see that Krishna is your employer. You're working for Krishna. So therefore, everything that you do is for His pleasure. It's not just when you come to the temple and you wave some incense or you put some money. That's not enough. Everything that you do, you have to see that I'm doing it to the very best of my ability simply to please Krishna. And when you have that consciousness, then, you know, if your spouse maybe is not acting properly, you know, or is in a bad mood, or whatever the case may be, you're not concerned, you're not upset, because you're not doing it to please them. You're not doing it to please them, you're doing it to please Krishna. So therefore you become detached. You're doing much better than if you were doing it for them, because some days you might not like them. There are days, it's not every day you're in love with them. It sort of wears off after a while. But you're doing it because your love for Krishna is increasing and you want to show Him that how much you're doing for Him, that you are a representative of Krishna. So there should be no fault in you. Right? That's an important consideration. That the mother is changing the diapers because she's doing it to please Krishna. She's taking care of her children because she wants to be the best mother possible so that she's pleasing Krishna. Do you want to please Krishna? So how else can we do it? We can only please Krishna with what we have available. Right? By our actions, our duties. So that's how we please Krishna. We haven't, you know, it's not that everybody is going to be able to just chant, you know, 192 rounds every day like Haridas Thakur. There's so many other processes which we have to imply. Like I said, you know, Arjuna on the battlefield of Kurukshetra was not chanting Hare Krishna. He was, you know, counting how many people he had to kill. He was, you know, just focusing on killing people. In the morning, everybody was doing their puja, but then they went out and performed their duties to please Krishna. So according to this, Srila Prabhupada says that therefore there would be no need to look into these material calculations, you know, which are according to Trigunya in the Vedas. But he says the whole issue though is if they are devotees. If. That's the big question. If. Because we see in ISKCON, and especially now happening in India, before it was only in the West, but now we're seeing in India, in ISKCON, divorces. Right? I can think of, atop my head, six couples who have divorced. Three of them in Bangalore. You know, when I first came to India in the late 70s and early 80s, there was no such number. I never heard of anybody getting divorced. The word divorce was maybe only found in a dictionary. Nobody ever used the word. It was never there. Never happened. So, but now, it's happening, isn't it? We can't deny it. Something went wrong. Something is not going the way it's supposed to be going. Well, first of all, one prime minister, see, if there was no divorce, then
I think it was Nehru. He changed the law. He legalized divorce so that his daughter could get divorced. And then that opened a whole Pandora's box. Now the opportunity is there for divorce. But if there's no opportunity for divorce, then people have to work it out. Because you have to be with that person. So you have to work it out. You just can't say, I'm going to just, you know, throw in the towel, I'm going to go to the lawyer, and that's it. No, you work it out. Because you have to see that person all the time. And of course also, they used to have better astrologers even 30 years ago. Then they go to an astrologer, they knew what they were doing. We'll get to that. So first of all, there was no ability to get divorced, and they had better arrangements for making good combinations. People, and also, people were much more concerned, they're more educated about performing their prescribed duties. Right? Like I just explained, you're doing your duty for Krishna. Of course, most people, you're just doing their duty according to Varna Ashram. Just do your duty because it's supposed to be done. But in Daivi Varna Ashram, as Krishna was explaining to Arjuna, you do it to please me. The Vaishnavas, they do their prescribed duties to please Krishna. Because then you make spirit. That's how you, it means you develop this service attitude. That whatever I do, it's for pleasing Krishna. If Krishna is not pleased, then I won't do it. The prime example of that is a very nice example in the Krishna book, is that of Pradyumna, Krishna's son. So he sets the example that if he liked to do something and then found out that Krishna didn't like it, well, then now he didn't like it. Because Krishna doesn't like it, so now, therefore I don't like it anymore. And if he didn't like something and then found out Krishna liked it, well, suddenly now Pradyumna liked it. Because that's what Krishna likes, so therefore I like it. Because the whole idea of Krishna consciousness, I mean, we can't control anything. We can't control how our hair grows, we can't control how we digest, we don't even know how these things are going. The only thing we can control is how we think. So the whole enterprise of Krishna consciousness is to conform our mind to that of Krishna. Krishna, that's what it means to be Krishna conscious. Not just thinking of Krishna, because Kamsa was also thinking of Krishna. Now, Ravana was also thinking of Ram. They were conscious of God, but they were not doing it in a friendly way. To become Krishna conscious, we have to conform our mind to that. When it says we are one with Krishna, meaning we are one in agreement. We are totally in agreement with Krishna. That's what it means to be Krishna conscious. That's what it means to be one, to merge. Not that we lose our personalities, but we are one in agreement. We're agreeing with whatever Krishna wants, then that's Krishna consciousness. Of course, sometimes Krishna likes it if you disagree with him, but that's only in special cases. You know, like Krishna liked Satyabhama because she was very fiery and she would always argue with Krishna, but she did that specifically because she knew that Krishna liked that. Krishna has special devotees who he has these type of relationships with. Otherwise, if everybody's just a yes man, it's not always fun. Like a king. A king keeps a jester. Somebody, a court jester whose whole job, their job is to insult the king. So because the king likes that. He likes being insulted by this man. If anybody else insults him, then they get their head cut off. But this person, he's allowed to insult the king. Like there was one... his name Gopal in Bengal. I can't remember his name right now. So the king asked him, "What's the difference between you and a fool?" So then Gopal measured the distance to the king, and he said, "About 1.5 meters, Your Honor." In other words, he's saying that the king was a fool. So. So basically, course, in the Vedas, they describe 8 types of marriages, but we're going to talk about a different kind of categorization of marriages. Love marriages, everybody knows what that is, right? Arranged marriages, and then deranged marriages. Love marriages, people are not, because that's becoming a little bit more popular in India. That's classified in the Vedas as a Gandharva Vivaha. You just like each other, you didn't ask anybody else, and you just exchange garlands and that's it. Like with Dushyanta and Shakuntala, that's a Gandharva Vivaha. The problem with Gandharva, the idea is that you marry the one that you love, right? Because you're in love with them, then you get married with them. But then many cases, in a lot of cases, after you get married, then the love affair ends. Right? Because the divorce courts are full of people that used to love each other. Right? As when Gaur Brother says, what started out as courting ends up in court. So they were in love, and then after they get married, the love stops. Whereas in an arranged marriage, a proper arranged marriage, the love affair starts after you get married. Huh? You love the one who you married, and then as you get to know them, then you develop love. I was just reading a review of 6 popular Indian movies about marriage, and that was the whole topic, was that how they were strangers before, and after the marriage, now they started getting to know each other, that's when the love began to blossom. And I've been to weddings, you don't see them very often now, where the first time it was at a Madhwa family, I can't remember the name now. So they had a sheet across the middle of the room. The boy came in from one side, the girl came in from the other side, they dropped the sheet, they looked at each other, they sat down at the fire sacrifice, and that's when they see each other for the first time at the wedding. You know, they're kind of looking at each other, like, who is this person I just got married, I'm going to be spending the rest of my life with. And so now the whole process of getting to know each other is there. But then, if an arranged marriage is done properly, then it works out. Because the parents are involved, they have a lot of investment in the children. They want the best for their children. So they investigate, they know what is the character of each of their child, they know what the person is like, and they do all the preliminary investigations, right? Similar with the other party. And they know the family, they investigate what is the family like, is it a good family, are they similar qualifications? And then they would go to a qualified astrologer and he would say yes if it was good or no, and then that would be it. And if it was good, then after the wedding, then the party, they like each other, they get along. And then it becomes a successful marriage which lasts until the end. Because there's a durability is there. But in deranged marriages, there's 2 types of deranged marriages. The deranged marriages of ISKCON in the West and deranged marriages of ISKCON in India. I've seen both. In the West, to sum it up, is that the way they would do it is that because they heard that there's arranged marriages, so that they didn't know that there was no vested interest in the part of the people who were doing the arranging. It was mostly like the temple president, not the parents. So if it goes wrong, then the boy or the girl's not going to go back to their father. It's going to be the temple president's fault, and he doesn't really care. But the idea was that this boy is if the people are collecting, well, you don't want them to get married because you want them to keep collecting, you want them to distribute books. So if the person's not doing very well, then get them married with that other person. They weren't really thinking about the best interest of the people involved. And then it came back to haunt them later because the marriages would be
would not, seldom would they last. It was all horror stories. But then, at first I used to be angry about it, but then I realized that they just didn't know any better. Because they really didn't know any better. Whereas in India, they know better, but they, not in every case, but there are certain tendencies which create real problems. One of the tendencies which create problems is the idea that we are a lot more advanced than we really are. So, if you read this sloka, this purport, the last few sentences, well, if you're devotees, then these things like astrology and these other endeavors to find a good match, these are unimportant. Simply, you're a devotee, that's good enough. You know, so therefore we take all the girls, you put them on this side of the room, you take all the boys, you put them on that side of the room, you put blindfolds on their eyes, and you just spin them around in a circle, and you just put them together, you push them toward each other, and whatever one you touch, that's the one who you're going to get married to, and that's going to be perfect. Why? Because you're both devotees. Does anybody here think that it's going to work? No. Why? I mean, I'm sure that there's people of devotees of the same gender that you don't like. What to speak of devotees of the opposite gender. Right? You know, like for example, Akrura, who is a pure devotee, didn't like Ugrasena, who's another pure devotee. Krishna's uncle and Krishna's grandfather didn't like each other. You know, and so there was what to speak of somebody who's not on such a high level. So just because they're, and of course, that's assuming that they're actually devotees, and because we can see being a devotee is not a cheap thing. It's a very high qualification to be a Vaishnava. It's not a cheap thing. Simply putting on tilak, coming to the temple, is a little bit more to it than that. Because we're seeing, how is it that these divorces are taking place? If that means that there's not so many devotees as we think. Krishna is saying, because as Krishna explains in the Gita, my devotee never falls down. But almost daily, you know, we're not, you know, Hanuman never fell. Arjuna never did anything, he fell down. So when Prabhupada is saying devotee, he's meaning really advanced devotees. Well, Srila Prabhupada, there was never a question in his mind about divorcing. So I've seen one example, one famous temple here in India, in the west part of India, where the qualification for the couple to get married was that the boy was working in the office, the girl was working in the office. That's it, the perfect match. They're compatible. They both work in the office, so therefore they should get married. This is a little bit, you know. The only problem is the girl didn't want to get married, and the boy didn't want to get married to each other. They didn't want to get married to each other. But the counselors, they said, no, that's not an issue. You should get married. They were like pushing them. They, you know, instead of being counselors, they were thinking that they were dictators. So they were pushing that this couple should get married. Pushing them, forcing them. So the boy, through one of my students, consulted me, and I said, no, you should. There's no question. You shouldn't get married to this girl. There's no way. It's never going to work. Finally, they convinced the girl that she should get married. So now had at least one side of it was interested, you know. so now they convinced her that she should get married, and then I told him not to get married, so they put pressure on him, and he got married. So they got married to each other. Immediately the crying started. She didn't want to touch her husband. If they have to put the hands together, there had to be a flower in between or a cloth in between. Within 12 days, the husband left the wife. After 12 days only. Within a year, they were formally divorced. Now, these counselors are not taking responsibility. Because Now, how difficult do you think it's going to be in India for a divorced boy or a divorced girl to get married again? Is it going to be easy? It's going to be difficult, right? So now they've basically ruined that couple's life. Only with great difficulty will they be able to get married. They didn't want to get married. Not like they rushed into it and it was a crazy love marriage. They didn't want to get married in the first place. But they were pressured by their mentors, by their counselors, to get married against their will. So that's what I call a deranged marriage. An example of a deranged marriage. Another example from here, in a little closer to home, where to do a compatibility, instead of going to a qualified astrologer, they buy an astrology program, some computer program, and they put in the birth data of both couples, and then they'll use what's known as the Kuta system. You know, there's Dasa Kuta, Ashta Kuta, and then it gives some number out of 36 points, how many you get, you know, and if you get a high number of points, then you're compatible. It's all based upon the nakshatra of the moon. Right? And if this is, you know, if it's compatible, then you should get married. But this is a very disastrous way of doing it, because that's not a very reliable system. It only takes into account the moon. And there are many, many cases where it's completely the opposite. I know of cases where you get the couple was of maximum compatibility and they didn't like each other. Because that's not a reliable way of doing it. You have to go to a qualified astrologer, not just plug in some information in a computer. You're not going to get the right information. I know one case where he was a client of mine, but he didn't like the advice I was giving him, because I kept telling him, no, don't do this, don't do that. He didn't like that I was always saying no. He didn't know that was for the best that he could, you know. No is also good, because if it saves you from getting in trouble, right? So he didn't like what I was saying. So therefore, for about a year, I didn't hear from him. Because he didn't want to just get a no. So then the next time I heard from him, he had gotten married. He bought a computer program. And then he met this girl. It was a very expensive, you know, matchmaking service. Cost 35,000 rupees just to join the service. And according to the computer readout, they were very compatible. 8 months later, not even a year, 8 months later, they had separated, and he and his mother and his family had to leave India because she was putting false charges on them. They were on the Interpol red list because, you know, she didn't need a lawyer. She just said that they were harassing me. Then she tried to steal all his father's property. That's an example of that. You shouldn't use a computer program to decide if you're compatible. So this also goes along. That also is happening with our in our devotees in our matchmaking system. That they're using this. They don't go to qualified astrologers. They just buy some cheap program and then they use that. And it just doesn't work. It's a very unreliable, specifically to. You know, it's not like you're buying a car or you're buying a pair of shoes, that if it doesn't work, you get another one. If you get married, you don't want to then, you know, find out it is not working. It's a lot easier, you know, to do your prescribed duty to please Krishna if you get along with the person that you're married to. Right? It becomes a lot more difficult if you just grit your teeth and, you know, try to please Krishna if you can't even speak to the person you're married to. So that becomes an issue. You know, as Chanakya Pandit said, that no wife is better than a bad wife. No son better than a bad son. No friend is better than a bad friend. And no servant is better than a bad servant. So to extrapolate from that, no astrology is better than bad astrology. If you can't find a qualified astrologer, then don't go to a bad one, or don't just use a computer, because you'll be fooling yourself. You'll be really, you know, because either you're about to get married, or you're married and you're going to have kids who are going to get married. So you should be listening carefully. You know, you don't want, you know, I had to deal with one divorce when they were not devotees, they were actually the Iyengars. Then divorce, you know, for thousands of generations, they never had any divorces. But then, you know, the brother was contacting me because his sister was growing up. She had grown up children. And she wanted to know, he wanted to know, like, you know, if what's happening to the marriage of his sister. And I said, it's not going to last. She treats him like a child. And there was silence on the phone. And he said, yes, he's always complaining that his wife treats him like a child. So he divorced his wife and he married his secretary. You know, because they said they didn't believe in astrology. So now, but it was a very obvious problem. So let's look about how to avoid deranged marriages. Because another thing is that if you read about devotees in history, most of them, they were very much attached to each other. They were very attracted to each other. And they went to great trouble in properly arranging their marriages, like, you know, like the Pandavas and Draupadi. With the Kshatriya families, they do tests to see if the boy is qualified. You know, they have all these, like, you know, how Ram had to string and break the bow, or Arjuna. You know, how he had to shoot the target in a very difficult situation. These are all tests to make sure that the spouse was qualified. Or even when Krishna with some of his wives went to get married, that the father-in-laws made him do very strenuous, of course for Krishna it was not strenuous, but anybody else who tried it, they were, you know, practically killed. And that's why they couldn't marry, you know, they had to tame 7 wild bulls and things like that. The whole idea was to test, to make sure that the person was qualified. So there are many tests that you have to, you know, perform before you get married. You know, so the first thing, of course, is that you should start early. You don't wait, you know, wait till your daughter's got her PhD. You know, that's not the time. By that time, she's freaking out. I just won one devoted girl in England. She's 34. She's practically having a nervous breakdown because she's not married. You know, she writes that she's having severe anxiety attacks because she's not married. You know, because girls, they tend to want to get married to somebody who is superior to them, somebody who they can look up to. So the more and more education they get, then that means the boy has to have more and more higher qualifications. That means their pool of who they can get married gets smaller and smaller. But then what happens, as in one case here in Bangalore, she was a doctor, she was in her 30s, but she couldn't get because she wanted this, and that, but then she's getting more and more desperate that she just forget about that. She just wanted to get married to anybody. Get married to anybody. Because it was getting late. It wasn't a doctor. Anybody. So it's foolishness. It's foolish to wait so long. And also, you know, then, you know, men can have children until they're, you know, their 90s. But women, there's a certain cutoff point when you can't have children anymore. So if you wait so late, it's not a good idea. It's not good. Because you're not able to have children then. And then then biological clock ticks and the girl becomes full of anxiety, full of anxiousness. So it's described that the boy and girl should be equal. Does that mean, what does it mean by equal? Does it mean like, you know, feminism, gender equality, that that they do, they're both able to do equal things? No, that's not what it means. It means equal in qualification. The same guna. Here in the text, Srila Prabhupada uses the word, you know, that a Brahmin should be married to a Brahmin girl like that. But actually, this is a bit of a misnomer, because girls do not have varna. Only boys have varna. Because, according as explained in the Gita, in Krishna explains that chaturvarna mayasrishtam guna karma vibhagasa, that varna is made up of two things, guna and karma. Right? So boys, males, according to their guna, they have four different karmas which they can perform. Right? If they have sattva guna, then they can take up the karma of a brahmana. If they are raja guna, they can take up the karma of a kshatriya. If they have the mix of raja and tama, then they can take up the karma of a vaishya. And if the guna is then tama, then they take up the guna, the karma of a shudra. But with a girl, whatever guna she may have, the karma is the same. They follow stri dharma. They take care of the house. Right? But they should have that guna. So a girl who has sattva guna, she should marry a boy who is a brahmana. Because he's also sattva guna. But he has the work of a brahmana. So the gunas should be the same. So that's a bit of a misnomer. So the girl, because a girl, she may be born in a Brahmin family, but she may have the guna of a raja guna or tama guna. It's not by birth, it's by what the guna is. So they should be equal in, like, for example, the Pandavas and Draupadi. You know, was Draupadi as strong as Bhima? No, was she as strong as 10,000 intoxicated elephants? No. Who was it? Which king was that? The Sindhuraj, who tried to rape Draupadi, right? Like, was it? I think I remember now. But you know, nobody could do that with Bhima. It's not strength of, you know, that she can do as many push-ups as Bhima could do. No, they were equal because she was equal in performing her dharma as they were in performing their dharmas. They were both at the same level in culture, both at the same level of learning, of education, of the education and their cultural values. That's equal. Equal in character. Equal in beauty. When they saw each other, it's described in the Mahabharata that after the Pandavas took Draupadi home, They couldn't keep their eyes off of each other. Draupadi was looking at her five husbands and they were looking at her. They were completely, totally mesmerized by each other's beauty. They were very attracted to each other. Not that, you know, that there was not any attraction. They were very attracted to each other. So attraction is there. So when they look to matching, you know, looking for a suitable partner for, you know, like that, there's four basic criteria. Four basic criteria. There should be a physical attraction, you know, physical compatibility, emotional, intellectual, and spiritual. The spiritual commitment. There may be other factors like, you know, community, you know, like that's a, but, you know, you, those are other factors, you know, like, but those are these are the four basic ones, that if they should be physically attracted to each other. That's, you know, that goes without saying. Otherwise, if there's no physical attraction, there won't be any children. And what's the purpose of getting married? Why are the people getting married in the first place if they don't care about what somebody looks like? The whole purpose of the people getting married is marriage is a civilized way of fulfilling a
a physical need. That we, logic, or one of the reasons of Krishna's Vedic civilization is how to live in this world with the intention of leaving the world. So living in this world, there's certain basic drives, necessities, which we can't escape. Like, for example, we have to eat. If we don't eat, we get very hungry. It's a pain. So how to satisfy that necessity in such a way that it doesn't entangle us in material life further? You know, we kill animals or things like that. You know, it gets more karma, samsara. So then we have prasad. So how to... there's another desire, which is for sex. That's inescapable. For people who are... there's only... Nara and Narayan Rishi are the only living entities in this world who are not agitated by sex desire. Everybody else is. So how to satisfy that in such a way that it doesn't entangle us in material life further into samsara? So that's why we have the vivaha samskara, marriage. It's actually, marriage is tapasya. It's an austerity. Because everybody wants to have unlimited partners. It's the nature of the mind. So it's a, so therefore there should be some attraction should be there between the couples. Then there should be some emotional compatibility, that they are sensitive to each other's feelings. Right? That there's not rough dealings between the two. That there's sensitivity. Like when One time when Sita and Ram, they had just met with Agastya Rishi. They were in a Dandaka forest and they were walking, because Agastya Rishi had requested Ram to go and kill all the Rakshasas. Right? So as they were walking towards the place, Sita, she didn't agree. She didn't think it was a good idea. But the way she presented herself to Ram was so humble. You know, she's disagreeing with her husband, and she prefaced her whole speech, you know, speaking very humbly, you know, I'm a less intelligent woman, this and that. But actually, I don't think we should go kill these people, because they never did anything to us. We don't even know them. But why are we going to go? They're strangers to us. They never did anything. So we're going to go over there and kill them? What do they do, you know? She said, we don't even, you know. So she was expressing her disagreement with Ram, but she expressed her disagreement in such a way that it was enchanting to him. He very much appreciated. She was sensitive to his feelings. He's the husband, he's the king, he's a Kshatriya. So she presented herself in such a way that it was very endearing. He was very touched by her concern. He just didn't say, you know, like, Ram, you know, you never listen to me, you know, you're just, you know, she didn't start yelling at him or screaming at him, or he wasn't, she didn't deal it like he's a henpecked husband. She dealt very tactfully, you know, sensitive to his feelings, and he appreciated it, you know. Then he responded that, you know, you have so much love for me that you're concerned about this and that. Then he explained, you know, the way she spoke with him was an expression of her love, and he could tell him. He could understand that she loved him from the way she was disagreeing with him. She disagreed with him in such a way that he felt that she was loving him. But then he didn't agree with her. But he spoke with her so nicely that he convinced her. So the point being is, they were sensitive to each other's emotions. They were not trampling on each other's feelings. So we can learn from how Sita and Ram, how they dealt with each other, how an ideal couple is concerned with the feelings of the other party. So this emotional sensitivity to each other is important. Not that we're, you know, we are always, that we're cold to the other person's feelings. Then comes intelligence. They should be on some level of equal intelligence, of education, that they can understand each other. And it's like somebody who's, you know, imagine imagine Einstein, somebody like a genius like Einstein, marrying some clerk, some girl working in, somebody, how are they going to communicate it? How will he be able to express his ideas? You want somebody who can understand you, who's intelligent. The wife may be subordinate, but subordinate doesn't mean stupid. It's like in the military, no commander, a commander, his ideal soldiers will be very intelligent, they'll take the initiative, they'll be very brave, they'll do everything, but they'll be also subordinate, they'll listen to their commander. Nobody wants a subordinate who's stupid. You want intelligent subordinates. You want people who are capable, because they're supposed to help you. So the wife is a subordinate, but she's also the helpmate of the husband. He doesn't want a wife who's stupid. He wants somebody who's level. So, but educated and intelligence are two different things. The wife may be ignorant, but ignorance can be combated by education. And stupidity cannot be combated by anything. It's irreversible. so they should. That even the gods strive in vain against stupidity. And Srila Prabhupada once was asked in Los Angeles, he was having a darshan with a bunch of PhDs, and somebody asked him, what was the definition of insanity? So he quickly replied, insanity, the sum total of all stupidity. Foolishness. Now, somebody may be intelligent, somebody may be educated, but they're still very foolish. They're educated fools. So, I don't want to belabor it too much, but you try to get some people who are on the same level that they can understand each other's ideas. Right? And as I said, after the marriage, the duty of the husband's family is to educate the girl. The girl continues getting education. So in a traditional Vedic culture, the girl got married at a very young age. And there's a reason for that. Because for the boy, he gets upanayana at a young age. Say about 6 years old, for 6 to 8 for a Brahmin, or a boy who's in Sattvaguna. A little bit older, say 8 to 10 if they're in Rajaguna. A little bit older, say 10 to 12 if they're in, Rajas and Tamas and Vaishyas. That's their initiation, the introduction into Vedic civilization. So that's also important for girls. Girls also have to be introduced in Vedic civilization. But they don't get upanayana. What's his name? Manu. Manu explains that for girls, they have all the same samskaras as boys, except upanayana. The girls don't get upanayana. For girls, they get vivaha. And for them, vivaha is the same as upanayana. And all the duties which they do in the house of their husband is equivalent to what the brahmachari does in the guru. In the ashram of the guru. They're cooking. See, the brahmachari has to every day do an agnihotra. So when the wife is cooking, that's the equivalent of the brahmachari doing his agnihotra. Right? And actually, speaking of which, the brahmacharis, that the ideal husband is a first-class brahmachari. Because he's controlled his senses. And also, for another reason, which is not mentioned in Shastra, because it wasn't really required then, is that today many ladies, they complain that their husbands don't appreciate them. Right? They don't appreciate all the work that the ladies do in the home. Cooking, taking care of the house. They don't appreciate. But if the boy had been trained as a brahmachari, he would appreciate. Why? Because he did every one of those duties himself. In the home of his guru. He cleaned the place. In the brahmachari ashram, you have to clean the floor. You have to cook. You have to clean your clothes. You have to clean the clothes of the guru. So you have to, you do every duty that your wife does after you get married. So you've done every duty your wife does, you've done it yourself. So you can appreciate what she's doing. And also you're not helpless. Now many men, they don't know how to cook. They don't know how to do anything. Because they were at home and just magically everything appeared. You know, food appeared. Somehow the house got cleaned. Somehow their clothes got cleaned by magic. You know. So then the ladies complained that, you know, I was doing the magic. You know, she's the Lakshmi of the house. That's why Manu also explains that that the men of the house should regularly give gifts to the ladies of the house. Regularly, you know, several times a year, they should give gifts to them. Buy them presents out of appreciation for the services that they do. You know, all your female relatives, your sister-in-law, your sisters, your mother, your wife, they should get them gifts. They explain like that. So, also then there has to be the spiritual compatibility. So like one friend of mine, his daughter is getting older now. So she wants to be a devotee, but not that heavy of a devotee. You know, she's only chanting one round. Right? So she wants to go to the movies, and she wants to be able to go to restaurants. So she wants to marry a boy devotee who's also like that. Not somebody who's, you know, like, you know, book distributor and you know, goes, you know, shaved up and wearing, you know, who's, you know, has, you know, not that strict, right? Because it's not going to work. They're both devotees, but different level of commitment, right? She likes the prasadam. She doesn't want to be, you know, a non-vegetarian. She only wants a vegetarian, like that. But there's a different level of commitment. If the boy was a strict devotee, he'd be frustrated with such a wife. Right? And the wife is also going to be frustrated with that kind of a husband. Though they're both devotees. But totally different level of commitment. Should be on the same level of commitment. The difference with this girl, though, is that now she's went from one round a day to four rounds a day. Because I told her, I said to her one day, so I asked her, how many rounds are you chanting? She said, one round a day. I said, oh, that's good. Next lifetime you'll be chanting two rounds a day. I was joking. But she like, it's really struck her, you know, like she didn't like that. Because she didn't want to have to take birth, and then, you know, that means like it would take a long time before you got to 16 rounds. But it had an impact. So now she's chanting four rounds a day. So now I said to her, well, you might have to change your criteria of who you want to get married to, because you're advancing now. So you have to, what if you marry a husband who only wants to chant four rounds a day, but then you go up to, then what are you going to do? You're going to be all upset. It's not going to, you know, so you have to be considering that, because it becomes a source of friction. That the husband wants the wife to do more, and she doesn't want to, like in the case of Srila Prabhupada, he said, my wife, she was a devotee in her own way, but she was not in the same way that Srila Prabhupada was a devotee. He was, you know, she wanted to, you know, drink tea. His idea of being a grihastha was, we make prasadam, we invite people over to our house, we feed them prasadam, we have kirtan, we discuss philosophy. That was not her idea. She was not enthused about that. In fact, one day, there was a little bit of a shortage of money. So she took Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavatam and she brought it to the merchant and she exchanged the weight in Bhagavatam for tea biscuits. And when she did that, then Srila Prabhupada said, you know, either tea or me. And she chose tea, so he left. And he never went back. Because there was a... She was not a devotee, but she was not... on the same level, not the same level of commitment. So these are important considerations, these four items. It's like a chair. There's a chair over there. That chair has got four legs. If there's four legs over there, you can sit on that chair. If you take out one of those legs, you can't sit on that chair. One of those criteria is missing, you can have difficulties. Difficulties in the marriage, and then it has an impact. You know, if the marriage breaks, it has an impact in the society. You know, why am I talking about this? Because it has an impact in the society, in our Krishna conscious society. Srila Prabhupada wanted that we establish Daivi Varnashram Dharma. So the basis of Daivi Varnashram Dharma is the Grihastha Ashram. You know, if the marriages are breaking up, it's not conducive to stability. If we have to need, you know, stable marriages. That gives stability for the children. That gives stability for the whole society. We see some place like the United States or Europe where they have, you know, it's ridiculous, you know, 50%, 60% divorces. The divorce rate is reducing, not because people don't want to get married. The only people who want to get married are the homosexuals. because they made homosexuality, they have legalized marriage for homosexuals, whereas the heterosexuals, they don't want to get married because then they get divorced. There's no incentive to get married in the West. You know, men don't want to get married because there's no incentive. First of all, that, you know, before, if you wanted sex, you had to get married. But now, you date a girl 3 times. If she doesn't want to have sex with you, you date a different girl. That's happening in India now. And if they got divorced, then the man lost everything. He lost his house, he lost half his salary, half his retirement, half his pension, and he saw his children 2 weekends in a month. 14%. They call them 14% fathers because they have their children 14% of the time. So you see men get their lives ruined that way. So after a while, seeing so many men getting their lives ruined, and since sex is so freely available, why get married? So there's the level of divorces are falling because few people are getting married. Only the homosexuals, they're fighting to get married. They ask one homosexual, why are you fighting to get married? And he says, so that we can experience the exquisite agony of getting divorced. So then after going through this whole, you know, of course the parents do all the screening, all the preliminary screening, you know, of all these. I remember I met one gentleman. He was a colonel in the Gurkha regiment. He said he went through 250 potential candidates for his daughter. 250. He was that concerned about that his daughter gets the right match. 250 horoscopes he went through to find a husband for his daughter. That much love he had for his daughter. He cared. You know, because he didn't want her coming home because they get divorced after. So then after the parents do the pre-screening, then you can go to an astrologer, a good astrologer, somebody who knows what he's doing. There are many bad astrologers. And if you can't get a good one, then don't get one at all. Don't go to, you can't, you know, better to have no astrologer than a bad astrologer. And then if everything else, then you let the girl or the boy see the other party. And if they like, then you can go forward. You know, I remember one case about 30 years ago. The girl was actually quite attractive. The boy wasn't that, you know, not even close. But she simply said, whatever my parents decide, I accept that. She's that humble. She had that much faith in her parents. I was shocked, completely shocked how much faith she had in her parents' decision. But she married him. They never got divorced. They were happily married. So if it's better if the parents do it, but if the parents, if the parents are not devotees, then still, you try. I always try to advise, try to get your parents involved. You know, you stipulate, because the one thing also is that I think I was explaining to one daughter of a friend of mine. You should make a list of everything you don't want in the person that you're going to marry. Because what you have to do is train your mind. The mind, the nature of the mind, it is kalpa and vikalpa, desiring and rejecting. So if you already program your mind with what you want and what you don't want, then it's a lot easier to make a selection. Because actually most people, they don't know what they want. So you first make a list what you don't want in a marriage partner. Things which you absolutely don't want. Then when you have that pretty much done, and you prioritize it, then you make another list what you do want. And you prioritize that. Now your mind knows. But before, you went to some wedding with your family, and there on the other side of the room was somebody who was very good looking, and they're looking at you, and then you look, and then the mind is not thinking anymore. No more thinking is going on. It's just, you know, lust is there, and you don't even know what it is that you want. Well, then mistakes can be. But if you know what you want, then you can easily decide. So these factors should be taken into account if we want to have a stable Krishna conscious society, you know, and that to have generations, you know, for future generations also stability. Because now in India we're seeing that divorce is becoming, you know, a growing problem. Like I said, I can just think of 6 devotee couples that got divorced. I just heard of one yesterday getting divorced. And so this is, this is not what we want. So do you have any questions or comments about the subject? Remember, it's either you're going to get married or you have children who are going to get married. Okay, let me read the verse. Ajamil said, "Alas, being a servant of my senses, how degraded I became. I fell down from my position as a duly qualified brahmana and begot children in the womb of a prostitute." Well, one more thing is, Janmashtami is coming. So that the temple is going to require a lot of assistance in organizing service, donations for having the function. So that they, to help as much as possible in cooperation for doing that. One thing that I like to do personally is to bring as much ghee for the function, because Krishna likes ghee. He shouldn't cook in oil. Krishna is not called Daldachur, right? Mother Yashoda was not cooking in vanaspati. She wasn't cooking in sunflower oil or soy oil or corn oil. She was cooking in ghee. So you can just go to Nandini, get Nandini ghee, not some other kind of ghee, Nandini ghee, it's pure ghee, and bring 10 kgs, 20 kgs of ghee. Then you can have everything cooked in ghee. Srila Prabhupada taught us that we should use oil is for the outside of your body, and ghee is for the inside. Right? Not the other way around. So I'll end there unless anybody has any questions. All right then.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Rama Hare. Hare Hare.